Of course, the last hitter-up turned out to be the blonde kid, whose name, they had heard by then, was Justin. "You can't get any more white bread than being a Justin," Kel had said on the bench when they all heard the Westchester coach call the blonde boy by name. Manny would say later that the one called ball Michael had thrown old Justin, the one with two strikes on him, should have been a strike too, but the ump had taken pity on the poor guy, not wanting to end the game on a punch-out. The ump had come out to clean off home plate after he called the pitch a ball. While he did, according to Manny, he looked up at Justin and in a real quiet voice said, "You better be swinging on the next one, son." Justin did swing, from his heels, but Michael blew the ball right by him. Ball game! At that point, Justin threw his bat against the back screen. The ump hadn't wasted any time calling out the Westchester coach and telling him that his star was suspended from the next game. The coach said that only happened if you got ejected, and that the ump couldn't eject somebody from a game that was already over. "Watch me," the ump answered. That was when Justin started yelling, as his coach tried to pull him away. The ump immediately pulled out his cell phone. The coach asked who he was calling. "The league commissioner," the ump said. "I want him to hear every word of this." That was when Justin finally shut up. At that point, Michael got into line with the rest of the Clippers, shaking hands with the Westchester players, all except Justin, who somehow managed to veer off and head back to his bench just before he got next to Michael, staring hard at him from a distance, still acting more pissed off at Michael than he was at the umpire who'd just clipped him for a game. "He can't be that mad just because I got him out," Michael said to Manny. "He must think it's impossible for anybody his own age to make him look like that much of a girl." "Hey," Michael said, "not so loud. We have a girl, remember? And she's good." They did. Maria Cuellar, whose parents were Puerto Rican, was the second fastest player on their team, after Kel. She played second base, could play third or short if she had to, and could hit. "I don't think of Maria as a girl," Manny said. "I think of her as one of us." "Really?" Michael said. "I watch you sometimes watching her, and you don't seem to look at her the way you do our other infielders." Manny turned to Michael, no expression on his face whatsoever, his voice completely calm, and said, "Shut up about Maria." "I'm good with that," Manny said, "just so we're clear." Mr. Minaya gathered them out in right field for a few minutes, the way he always did after games, went over what he liked about what they'd done today, what he didn't like, told them what he told them after every game, that the object was to have fun, but to learn something every single time they went out there. You never know what thing you learn might make the difference between making it to Williamsport and watching the games from your sofa, he said. It had already reached the point in the season, Michael and his teammates knew, where Mr. Minaya wasn't really interested in whether or not they were having fun. That was just his cover story. He wanted to make it to the World Series as much as any kid on his team, and maybe more. Sometimes, when Mr. Minaya got going about the World Series, he sounded a lot like Poppy, which meant he made Williamsport, Pennsylvania, that ballpark you'd see on television with happy parents in the stands and no highways in the distance, sound like baseball heaven. "Did you hear me, Michael? Or were you in Williamsport already?" "I was, actually," Michael said. "Sorry, coach. I was asking if anybody needed a ride over to Crotona Park on Tuesday night," Mr. Minaya said. Michael looked down at his old baseball shoes, that hole in the toe of his left one, as he said, "I could use a ride." There was a pause before Mr. Minaya said, "Can't your father bring you?" Michael, trying not to look nervous, said, "No." "He's still not back from Florida?" Michael shook his head. "I wondered why he hadn't called me back." "It's still just Carlos and me," Michael said. "But Mrs. Cora looks out for us." Mr. Minaya said he would swing by and pick Michael up at 4:30. Michael said he'd be out front. Mr. Minaya said,
I hope your uncle gets better soon. It would be a shame if your father misses our first playoff games after missing the whole regular season.
Michael just nodded and told Mr. Minaya he would see him on Tuesday, told Manny he could call him later, picked up his glove and bat, and started walking fast in the direction of the stadium. Then he was running, jogging at first, but then sprinting, just wanting to get home to the apartment, afraid to look back, afraid they might still be watching him. He didn't want Mr. Minaya or his teammates to see him crying about the father that had been dead since May. Chapter 5. Michael remembered how his father used to laugh when he'd hear one of the sports announcers say something about how heart could only carry an athlete or a team so far.
Little do they know, he said.
Then he'd give two little taps to his chest, the way the big league ball players did sometimes just after they'd hit a home run. Their grandfather, Papi's father, had died young of something to do with the heart, and so had their great-grandfather. Papi had never made a secret of that. And once, back in Havana, when Michael was 5 or 6, Papi had been in the hospital for a few days with what their mother described as a mild attack to the heart. Papi laughed off that one, too.
Mild, he said. Usually means it attacks somebody else's heart.
Then he would tell them not to worry. He would not only die an old man, he would die in America. It turned out he was half right. Some of it Papi told Mrs. Cora himself when he made it back to her apartment that day. Some of it Carlos found out later on his own because he said he had to know. All of it became their secret. Their father had been driving his gypsy cab on Kingsbridge Road, the middle of May, right before Memorial Day weekend. His fare was a woman. Papi let her off in front of her apartment building, and she paid him. It was a beautiful day, and so he had the windows down, and just as he was pulling away, he heard shouting from behind him. A man had been waiting for the woman. An ex-boyfriend, Carlos would find out later. Papi stopped his Crown Vic, the one with 100,000 miles on it, watching the argument now as well as listening to it. He saw the man raise a hand to the woman, knock her to the ground.
The rule is that once they are out of the car, they are no longer your responsibility, he said later to Mrs. Cora. But that was not my rule.
Papi got out of the car, yelled at the man to stop. The man turned and yelled at him to mind his own business. The woman on the ground was crying. When Papi came up on them, the man took one swing before Papi put him down. A neighbor would tell Carlos this part. The man got up, tried to charge Papi like a bull, but Papi put him down again. That's when he felt something grab in his chest.
He tells me this as he begins to fade, Mrs. C. later told Michael and Carlos. Like an old photograph.
The woman later told Carlos, when he went to visit her, that she had thought something was wrong with Victor Arroyo then, but he had told her he was just too old to be engaging in schoolyard fights. At this point, the woman's ex-boyfriend had had enough and ran off. Papi told the woman to call the police and got into his car and drove away. Papi, even in America, had always warned his sons, you never want to spend too much time talking to the police. He managed to drive home, getting back to their building just as Mrs. Cora was coming back from noon mass. Papi told her he felt as if a bomb had gone off inside his chest. She took him inside to her apartment.
I am dying, he said.
The way he said it, a look he had, told Mrs. C. he was telling her the truth.
Let me call a doctor, she said.
No,
he said.
A priest. One who will keep my secret.
What secret?
Mrs. Cora said.
The secret, he said. That I am gone.
It was already too late for the priest. Papi held on to Mrs. Cora's hand,
telling her,
"Keep my boys together."
His last words. Then he died. Father Montoya came and gave him the last rites. Mrs. Cora told him that he was to tell no one, not even at the church, about Papi's death. He asked why. She said because those were the father's wishes, that he had explained to Mrs. C that if something he had called the family court found out the boys had no parents and no relatives, they would come for them. Mrs. Cora said to the boys later, "The priest asked who would take care of you two. I told him you would take care of yourselves." The super had a cousin who ran a funeral home over near Kennedy Airport in Queens. He handled the details of the burial at a small cemetery near the Aqueduct racetrack. Father Montoya drove Carlos, Michael, Mrs. C. The boys used the emergency money they knew their father had kept in a box in the cupboard to buy a cheap casket. They made sure that the man from the funeral home put Papi's old catcher's mitt inside with him, and the new ball he and Michael had played catch with the day before he died. They came home, and Carlos went looking for work. Mrs. Cora said she would adopt them as her foster children if she could, but her late husband had never bothered to get his papers, and besides, she barely had enough money of her own to live on. Papi had no brothers or sisters. Their mother, the one who had died so young of cancer Michael could not even remember her, had sisters still living in Cuba, but neither Carlos nor Michael had spoken to them in years or had any idea how to get in touch with them. From the time their mother had died, it had just been the three of them, father and two sons. The father who had always told them he was going to die old and die free, until his own great heart could only carry him so far.
"Maybe some family could adopt the two of us," Michael said one night when Carlos was at the kitchen table figuring out again how much money they would need to get by once the last of Papi's emergency money ran out.
"One teenage boy and another about to be a teenager," Carlos said. "Maybe there is that kind of family on a TV show, in the TV world, but not in the real world." He shook his head.
"No, we just have to find a way to get by until I turn 18.
"That's not until next spring," Michael said.
"Little brother," Carlos said, "believe me, if I could change my birth certificate, I would."
"Will they really separate us if they find out?"
"I can only tell you what I read, mostly on the internet," Carlos said. "There's something where they say they would try to keep siblings together, but they can't guarantee it. If someone finds out about Papi, then we go into family court. And after that, little brother, then it's up to them, the official people. If they can't place us in a foster home, then we could go into a group home, maybe even back to Cuba."
"I want to stay here," Michael said. "This is our home."
Carlos got up from the table, came over, hugged him hard. "And it's going to stay our home, Miguel. We are going to stay a family, and we are going to live in this apartment until you graduate from high school and the Yankees come and offer you a big bonus contract, and then..."
"What?"
"Then we live happily ever after in America, the way Papi promised."
"You think we can keep everybody from finding out?"
"Do we have a choice?" Michael said,
"I'm afraid."
It was something he would never admit to Manny, or the other Clippers, or even Mrs. C.
"Let me worry," Carlos said. "You just pitch."
So they came up with the story, anytime anybody would ask, that Papi had gone to visit a sick brother in Key West, Florida, and that Mrs. C was looking out for them. Whenever someone new would ask, Carlos would just tell them that Papi had only been gone a couple of days. This had gone on for 3 months. Carlos worked and worried. Michael pitched. A family of three had become, in Michael Arroyo's young mind, an army of two.
Chapter 6.
The girl showed up again. It was 2 days after the Crotona game, which the Clippers had won 3-2. Michael had pitched the first three innings, struck out 8 of the 9 batters he faced before handing the ball and the game over to Anthony Fierro, and watching Anthony pitch his best 3 innings of his All-Star season from there.
There was no game or practice scheduled for the next day, but Manny told Michael he'd meet him at McCombs after his doctor's appointment for his stupid allergies, somewhere around 3 o'clock. Michael knew that could mean anywhere between 3 and 4. He operated on Manny's standard time, and there was no getting around it if you were Manny Cabrera's friend. He was loyal, funny, smarter than he let on, loved baseball as much as Michael. There were so many good points with Manny that Michael couldn't keep track of all of them. But none of Manny's good points, not a single one, involved him showing up on time for anything except a real game. So instead of going straight down to the field, Michael decided to stop at the stadium first. That night, the Yankees were going to play the last game of an 11-game homestand, El Grande on the mound. Michael had found a brand new ball in the apartment, stuck it in the pocket of his glove, stuck a magic marker in his pocket, and walked around the stadium to where the blue barriers had been set up near the Yankee souvenir store, the one with so many of the players' jerseys in the front window. El Grande's number 33 was front and center. Michael had heard the radio announcer saying the other day that it was currently outselling all the other Yankees' jerseys combined. As usual, most of the people waiting for the players to arrive were adults, carrying their own balls and programs and photographs and notebooks. Carlos had once said these were the people who only wanted autographs so they could turn around and sell them. "But if you were lucky enough to get your favorite player to sign something," Michael had said, "why would you sell it?" "Because baseball is a business to these people," Carlos answered. "Even a signature from one of their heroes."
"It's different with me," Michael said.
"And always will be," Carlos said. Now, behind the blue barriers, Michael slithered to the front of the crowd as the people around him cheered and called out to Joe Johnson, the Yankee first baseman, and the rookie catcher Tony DeVeronica, short and squat, built like an older version of Manny. Out of the parking lot after them came the new Japanese right fielder, Sasaki. "No El Grande." Michael watched as a few more players arrived, a couple of the Yankee broadcasters. Finally, he asked a boy about his age if El Grande had arrived yet.
"You missed him by like 10 minutes, the boy said. "But it wouldn't have done you any good. The guy walked right past us like we weren't even here."
Michael said,
"He's pitching tonight. He probably doesn't stop to sign on days when he's pitching."
"Dream on," the other boy said. "I've never seen the guy even look over here." "Dream on," Michael thought to himself, and made his way across Rupert Place and across the basketball courts to wait for Manny, who actually showed up at 3:30, almost on time if you were using Manny's standard time.
"Before you say anything, my arm hurts from my shot," Manny said.
"Did the shot make you walk slower getting here?"
"It's not your fastball I'm going to remember someday," Manny said. "It's your compassion."
"I'm sorry about the shots," Michael said. "Really? Though, if they'd give it to you in your butt, you probably wouldn't have felt anything."
"Ha ha," Manny said. "Ha ha ha."
He went and got behind the plate without being asked. Michael knew by now that it was the same with Manny the catcher as Manny his friend. He would do anything for Michael, on or off the field. It was never something the two of them discussed or that required a thank you from Michael. But if he announced right now that he wanted to throw pitches to Manny Cabrera for an hour straight, Manny would just nod. And in an hour, would still be snapping back throws to Michael out of his crouch as if Michael had just thrown his first pitch of the day. He'd still be yelling,
"Now you humming, bud!"
He wouldn't even think about stopping until Michael did. This was one of the moments when he wanted to thank Manny, or at least try, even if he knew he wouldn't get anywhere, because he never had in the past.
"You know," Michael said, "I don't think I could even think about pulling this thing off without you."
They both knew how much trouble Manny would be in if his mom ever found out about the secret Manny was keeping. Knew from Carlos that any adult who found out about two children living without an adult was supposed to report them, by law, to something called the Administration for Children's Services. Manny didn't want to hear about it.
"Shut up and pitch," he said.
Michael did, getting himself loose, keeping track of the number of warm-up pitches he'd thrown before starting to cut loose,
throwing as hard as he could before long, somehow becoming more accurate as he did, hitting Manny's mitt wherever he had it set up. Inside corner, outside corner, high in the strike zone, low, it didn't matter. Michael hit the glove almost every time. Manny finally stood up, soft tossed the ball back to Michael.
You might not need a break, Star,
he said, Star being his personal nickname for Michael.
But I do. Let's get a drink.
Michael said he was cool with that and walked in from the mound. Manny waited for him at home plate. When Michael got there, Manny was looking past him toward the outfield, grinning.
Check it out,
he said.
Check what out? We have an audience,
Manny said. Michael turned around. There she was, out behind the center field fence, staring right at him. He still had the ball in his left hand, and without thinking about this either, he suddenly planted himself and wound up and chucked the ball all the way out there, an even longer throw than he made to get the purse dealer, put it on one bounce over the fence to where she was standing. He stood there now with his hands on his hips, hoping she could see him smiling at her. The girl, in her long-legged blue jeans, wearing a pink t-shirt today that had something written on the front, walked calmly around the fence like she had all the time in the world, or like she was waiting to decide just what she wanted to do. When she got to the ball, she looked at him, then put her hands on her hips, like she was mimicking him. Then, the pretty mystery girl with the long legs picked the ball up and then threw it back to Michael. On the fly. Michael turned around and looked at Manny, who was staring at the girl in the distance the way you stared at fireworks the first time you see them in the sky.
I saw, Manny said.
Michael stepped back behind the plate now to show her his arm was better and threw the ball back, really gunning it, putting everything he had into it like he was trying to throw it into the river, wanting to make sure he got this one over the fence without any bounces. The ball tracked on the mystery girl all the way, like it was a fly ball in a video baseball game that you were carefully guiding into an outfielder's glove. When it got to her, she reached up, casual, like a big league outfielder making a routine out, and caught the ball in her glove, one he hadn't even noticed she had on. From behind Michael, Manny said,
"Can of corn!"
Michael barely heard him. He was staring at the girl still, wondering where the two of them were going with the strangest game of catch he'd ever played.
"You ever see an arm like that on somebody our age?"
Michael said finally.
"Yeah," Manny said. "Yours."
"Who is she?" Michael said.
"Just a girl,"
Manny said.
"With Superboy's arm."
"A girl I've seen twice now," Michael said. "I didn't mention it, just 'cause I didn't think it was important, but she was watching us on Saturday when we were messing around in that pickup game."
"With that guy, Escope?"
"Yeah."
"You talked to her?"
"I was going to, because I swear, I thought she was laughing when I was pitching to him that day. Like she found it funny."
"Well, dude, maybe she just noticed how funny you looked, even from a distance,"
Manny said.
"Very funny," Michael said. "And don't call me dude."
They looked over. She was watching them, keeping her distance still, throwing the ball up in the air, catching it with her glove behind her back. Michael held up his glove, telling her to throw it back. She did. On the fly. Again. She was right-handed. She had, Michael could see, a beautiful motion, graceful, as if it wasn't taking any effort at all to throw the ball as far as she was throwing it. Inside his own head, not wanting to give Manny any kind of opening, Michael thought, she definitely does not throw like a girl.
"We gotta meet her," he said.
"Okay," Manny said.
"But let me do the talking."
Michael said,
"What's that supposed to mean?" "It means that you do not possess the ability to talk to girls in any sort of coherent manner."
"Coherent manner?" Michael said. Did you get that out of one of your books?
Manny Cabrera, Michael knew, didn't just love baseball and dancing and watching movies, and maybe Maria Cuellar. He loved to read, too, even if that was another secret he kept from their teammates. He loved to read books that weren't even assigned on their summer reading list, so he was always dropping what sounded like grown-up expressions on Michael. Manny shook his head now.
Actually, he said, Jim Cott used that one with Michael Kay on the Yankee game the other day, saying that when there's a runner on second who could be stealing signs, Joe Johnson doesn't always put down his signs in what would be considered a coherent manner.
Whatever, Michael said. And Ken, too, talk to girls. I talk to Maria more than you do.
I'm talking about talking to girls you don't know, Manny said, which is when you turn into one of those guys in the scary movies who can't even get their screams out. Do not.
Do, Manny said.
Infinity.
Michael looked back over at the mystery girl. She was still there. Let's go, before she disappears again, Michael said. The two of them started walking toward her. She didn't run, this time. Chapter 7. Her t-shirt read, Girls rule, boys drool. She said her name was Ellie.
Ellie Garcia,
she said, and then gave them a look Michael couldn't read, as if she knew something they didn't, or was just trying to act mysterious, which is something girls did all the time. Manny said they couldn't help it. It was in their DNA. After Manny handled the introductions for them, Michael said, You didn't try to escape today.
I didn't run away the other day. I was just late to be somewhere.
Up close, she was the most beautiful girl Michael had ever seen. This, he knew, was an observation coming from a boy who had no real interest in girls, other than his usual observation about them, which was how different they were from guys.
That will change sooner than you think, Carlos always said when they'd have a conversation about girls.
I have no time for them,
Michael would say back, and Carlos would laugh and say,
Oh, you'll make time.
Michael wasn't so sure about that. All he knew with this girl right in front of him, not 100 yards away now, was this. Ellie Garcia was different than all the other girls. He pictured her being the best player on her girls' team by a mile.
How old are you?
He said in a voice as loud as a door slamming. Ellie jumped, as if Michael had yelled directly into her ear. Manny put a hand on Michael's shoulder.
Someday, he said. My friend's dream is to host his own interview show on television. I would say like Total Request Live, except he doesn't watch MTV. No baseball highlights.
Very funny, Michael said. He felt himself coloring the way he knew he did when he was embarrassed. Manny liked to say it turned his coloring from baseball glove to New York Mets orange.
Ellie smiled. I turned 12 last month.
Her accent, Michael noticed, was slightly heavier than his own, but pretty somehow, the way she was.
Where are you from?
Michael said.
The interview continues, Manny said.
The Bronx,
Ellie said. At the same moment, both Michael and Manny said,
Which part?
All three of them laughed. Ellie pointed to her left at the cars going north on the Deegan.
Up there, she said. But how come you two get to ask all the questions?
We don't, Manny said. Your turn. And don't worry, I'm like Radio Shack. If you've got questions, I've got answers.
Ellie said,
I have no idea what you're talking about.
Join the club, Michael said.
Okay,
Ellie said.
I'll keep it simple. Who are you guys?
Manny then tried to tell her both his and Michael's life stories in the space of about 5 minutes. What his father did, where he lived, where they went to school, how Michael and Carlos and Papi had come over on the boat, everything except what had happened to Papi. When he finally stopped, just to take a breath, Ellie said to Michael,
You're Cuban? Really?
Cuban-American now, he said. That's what I'm taught to say.
He tilted his head at her.
Where are you from?
The mystery look again. Same small smile.
Oh, I'm from the Caribbean too, she said.
Ellie Garcia, Manny said. From somewhere in the Bronx and somewhere in the Caribbean before that. The girl who shows up out of nowhere to throw like a boy.
And you, Mr. Manny Cabrera, talk more than one of my girlfriends? She said.
Michael laughed too loudly at that one. Manny gave him his shut-up look. Michael asked Ellie if she could hang around for a while.
Does that mean you're asking me to play? She said.
He said yeah, he guessed he was. Then Michael said, I can't tell who's the cat here and who's the little mouse.
You're the cat, Ellie said. Like one my father used to sing to me about when I was little, Missy Foos the cat.
Michael couldn't believe his ears.
My father used to sing to me the same song, he said. Missy Foos dormido en su cama está. Missy Foos the cat is sleeping on the bed, she said.
Michael said, I thought it was just a Cuban song.
My father told me it was our song, she said.
They both knew about Missy Foos. Cool, he thought. She reached into his glove, took the ball out, smiled at him one last time, again looking to Michael like there was some joke she wouldn't let him in on.
I'll pitch, she said.
And Michael said he'd catch for a change.
A left-handed catcher?
Ellie said.
As much as it physically pains me to admit this, he's not just the best pitcher on our team, he's the best catcher too, Manny said. And the best center fielder, and...
Enough, Michael said. Ellie said to Manny,
But I thought you were the catcher.
Only because he's the best pitcher and the best center fielder, Manny said.
Please shut up and hit,
Michael said. They agreed that everybody would get 10 hits, then they'd go pick up whatever balls there were scattered around the field before it would be somebody else's turn at bat. The problem for Manny was getting his bat on the ball 10 times. He hit a few of Ellie's pitches at the start, when she wasn't throwing her hardest, but when she turned up the heat, the way Michael did when he got loose, Manny started to miss, badly. Finally, he dribbled one to where the second baseman would have been, which made 9 hits for him.
Okay, Michael said to his friend. 2 outs, bottom of the 9th, runners on 2nd and 3rd, our team down by a run. Base hit sends us to Williamsport.
There's an open base, Manny said.
If she knows what's good for her, she'll walk me.
Base is loaded then, smart guy. No place to put you.
Does that mean I can pitch from a full windup? Ellie said.
Manny whistled through his teeth, the way he did when he was impressed by something.
She's good, he said.
Michael said,
An ice cream says you don't put the ball in play. Make it both our dinners at McDonald's. We were going there anyway. You okay with that?
I'm good, Michael said.
Carlos gave me money. It's on then.
Manny fixed his helmet, dug in the way he did with his back foot, the one closest to Michael, wiggled his bat back and forth. Ellie threw one past him, down the middle, a blazer for strike one. As Michael threw the ball back, Manny said,
Good hit a swing and miss sometimes on a pitch they like, so the pitcher will throw it again.
I never heard that one, Michael said. Ellie threw strike two past him, same place, maybe a little closer to the outside corner.
That pitch you wanted her to throw again?
Michael said, trying not to grin.
I think she just threw it.
Manny kept his eyes on the girl.
Shut up,
he said to Michael.
But, Michael said, ignoring him, if I'm following your thinking here, you've got her right where you want her.
Manny wiggled his bat harder, the way Gary Sheffield did, his face suddenly serious, as if this were a real game, real bottom of the 9th. The field full of players. Instead of just the 3 of them on an afternoon, Michael suddenly wanted to last forever. Now Michael watched, as Ellie went into the same high-kick windup Michael used. Was she trying to copy him? And threw a total screamer, a smoke alarm, past Manny Cabrera for strike 3. When the ball was in Michael's glove, he looked out at her. She hadn't even changed expression. Or maybe she was just trying to keep a straight face. She didn't say anything, and neither did he. And neither did Manny. Michael hadn't even moved his glove yet. Of course,
Manny spoke first. He dropped his bat, turned to Michael, and in a little boy voice said,
I could use a hug.
They all laughed again. Ellie had a good laugh. She wasn't shy when she laughed or embarrassed, just happy. When they stopped, Ellie said to Michael, I haven't had a chance to hit against you yet. I've already thrown enough today, he said. And besides, we've got a game tomorrow. Ellie put a hand on her hip, tilted her head a little, gave him a suspicious look.
Afraid a girl might get a hit off you? She said.
No, he said. I'm never afraid somebody might get a hit.
Is that bragging?
No, Michael said, blushing again, he knew. I just mean that putting your best up against somebody else's, that's not something that should make you afraid. That's the fun of it all. He wanted to explain to this girl he'd just met that there were plenty of things that made him afraid, just not baseball. Baseball always made him happy, never happier than today, he thought. And if I did pitch to you and let you get a hit, you'd know it, Michael said.
How do you know that? Ellie said.
Because you're just like me, Michael said. They were sitting in the grass, a few yards from home plate. Manny had gone to get his cell phone out of his bat bag, saying he had to call his mom. Ellie said she had to go soon. Michael asked, where? Ellie answered,
no more questions for today.
As she said it, Michael saw that her eyes were focused on the area behind home plate, on the other side of the screen.
Who's who with Manny?
Who's who with Manny? Michael said.
The policeman and the other man, she said.
Chapter 8. Michael recognized the policeman who had handcuffed the purse dealer after Michael had hit him with the longest knockdown pitch ever, put the guy down not too far from where he and Ellie were sitting right now. The other man wore a white shirt and tie, even in the heat, carrying his jacket over his arm. He was smiling at Manny, then nodding, then laughing at something Manny said, then lifting his chin and nodding in Michael's direction.
Do you know them? Ellie said.
The policeman I do. Officer Crandall is his name. Officer Mark Crandall. I met him the other day.
And who's that with him?
She was trying to angle her body to get a better look because the policeman had moved now and was blocking her view.
An official person, Michael said,
knowing he was talking in capital letters.
How can you tell?
Ellie grinned.
Officially, I mean.
I just can. Now he saw the official person giving Manny a friendly shove in their direction, the kind the coach gives you when he tells you to go get in the game. Manny jogged toward the outfield while Officer Crandall and his friend sat down on the home team's bench, on the first base side of the field. Michael got up now, so did Ellie. When Manny was about 20 yards away, Michael couldn't wait any longer.
Who is that?
He said. Ellie had moved a few steps closer to home plate, squinting into the sun at the two men. Before Manny could answer, she said,
He works for the Bronx Borough President, Mr. Amorosa. I forget his exact job.
Manny said,
He works in public relations for Mr. Amorosa. He just told me.
He stared at Ellie.
But how do you know him?
Michael thought Ellie seemed nervous all of a sudden, even though he had no idea what she had to be nervous about.
I met him one time, she said, with my dad.
Anyway, Manny said to Michael,
he wants to meet you is all. It turns out Officer Crandall said something to one of his superiors about what you did with Ramon. That was the thief's name, Ramon. And the superior said something, and it somehow ended up in Mr. Amorosa's office. The other man with Officer Crandall, Mr. Lima, he says they want you and your parents to come down and have your picture taken with Mr. Amorosa. People hear so much about crime in the South Bronx, he said, they want to play up their 12-year-old crime stopper.
Michael felt himself looking all around Macomb's damn park now, all corners of the green grass, everywhere, except at the two men on the home team's bench. He was never, under any conditions, supposed to talk to any official person without Carlos. The only reason that he had talked to Officer Crandall that day was because he had no choice. He had been afraid that if he ran off when he saw a policeman coming, he would look as guilty as the Ramon guy.
What did you tell him? Michael said.
Mr. Lima, I mean.
You see him laughing before? Manny said. I tried to make a joke of it. I told them they were talking to your agent, and that I'd have to go clear it with you first. That's when Mr. Lima told me to go clear it already.
Manny turned now, put on his biggest smile, waved at the two men, held up a finger. One more moment, please. From behind them, Michael heard Ellie say,
I've got to go.
He turned his head and saw her running toward Rupert Place, the same as she had the first day.
Wait!
He yelled at her back. But she kept running, around the end of the basketball court, up the hill, toward the flow of people heading for the gates at Yankee Stadium. She held up her hand in some kind of wave, without breaking stride. Michael looked at her, looked back at Officer Crandall and Mr. Lima, said to Manny, Wait for me at McDonald's. He ran after her.
Michael, wait!
Manny said.
What the heck am I gonna tell him?
Over his shoulder, glove in his right hand, one ball still in the pocket, chasing after the baseball girl, one who seemed to have secrets of her own, Michael smiled, even as scared as he was.
Tell them the truth, he shouted at Manny. Tell them this is the first day of my whole life that I started chasing girls.
Only when he looked up the hill, she was gone. Again. There was another policeman right in front of Michael as he came racing up the hill, on this street where he always imagined his baseball world ended and the Yankees began. He wanted to ask the man if he had seen a pretty girl with a baseball glove under her arm. Then he stopped to catch his breath, imagining how a scene like that would play itself out. What was he going to ask this policeman? Had he seen a girl with a baseball glove outside the stadium before a home game? The man would probably look at him and say,
Oh, I've seen about 50. Would you care to narrow it down a little bit?
Michael knew there was no point in even looking for Ellie up here, or asking anybody for help, or trying to explain why this friend of his, a girlfriend, was running away from him in the first place. So he slowed down now and walked right past the policeman, who seemed to be guarding the stadium club entrance to the stadium. When he got to the corner of 161st and Rupert, he stopped to look back on the field at Macomb's Dam Park, saw Manny in the distance, walking away from the Little League field with Officer Crandall on one side of him and Mr. Lima on the other. Michael could see Manny chattering away, talking with his mouth and his hands at the same time, in a way that always made Michael wonder if the hands were trying to keep up with the mouth or if it was the other way around. He saw Manny look up at one man, then the other, then saw both men start to laugh. Manny the Entertainer, like that guy Cedric the Entertainer on television. It had been such a perfect day, Michael thought to himself. Him and Manny and Ellie Garcia, laughing and playing ball and inventing games and being happy to be on the field and with each other. A perfect summer day, when it was as if Michael could hypnotize himself, make himself believe that everything was going to work out right, that the Clippers would make it to Williamsport, that he and Carlos wouldn't be found out before Carlos turned 18, that he and his brother would always be together. Except now, an official person had come to his field, which in the summer was as much his home as 825 Girard. What was he going to do the next time this Mr. Lima came around? Michael felt himself shiver, even though the heat of the day had carried over into early evening to when the Yankee game was set to begin. They knew where to find him now. It was Carlos's regular night off from Hector's, so he and Michael and Manny were chowing down on all the food Manny and Michael had brought from McDonald's, listening to the Yankee game on the radio. Actually, Michael was doing most of the listening while Manny caught Carlos up on what had happened at the field. As always, Manny made himself out to be the hero of everything. It was another part of their deal, except on the ball field. Once they got to the ball field, Manny was always content, or so it seemed to Michael, to play the part of sidekick.
They definitely asked you for Michael's last name? Carlos asked Manny.
I thought about giving them a middle name or something, just to throw them off for now, Manny said, his mouth full of fries. But if they found out later that I'd lied about something that easy to find out, I figured they'd be asking themselves why I lied about something that easy to find out.
But they didn't ask you for an address? Carlos said.
Nah, Manny said.
He looked at Michael across the table.
You gonna finish your fries?
He said. Michael shook his head. Manny grabbed a handful, said,
I think they were probably about to ask me where, but it was right then that my boy here decided to run after his new sweetie. I was running away from them, Michael said. And she is not my sweetie, dorkball.
Michael got up and walked over to where the radio sat on the coffee table, wanting to hear better and not wanting to have Manny catch him blushing again. Top of the third for the Orioles, runners on second and third against El Grande. Two outs. Manny wouldn't let up, of course.
You told me you were running after her, remember?
Manny said.
Shh,
Michael said. Then listened as John Sterling, the Yankee announcer, his voice excited, said,
He struck him out!
And El Grande was out of the inning. At least somebody was winning something today. Chapter 9. They had driven up to New Rochelle to play Westchester South, the team they all thought of as the Justins now, in the old blue bus from the small bus company near the 3rd Avenue Bridge that Mr. Minaya managed, in what he called his day job. Manny joked with Mr. Minaya that the shock absorbers from this particular bus seemed to have turned into shock producers, but the kids loved the old bus anyway, loved the idea of any kind of road trip out of the Bronx, just because it made them feel big. The field in New Rochelle turned out to be beautiful, the infield and outfield grass looking as if they were being cared for by big league groundskeepers like Kel's dad. Even the infield dirt had been raked before they got there. There were colorful ads for local stores on outfield walls that looked pretty close to Michael, pitchers always noticed, and a concessions truck set up in the parking lot behind home plate, and even new-looking bleachers on both sides of the field for the home team and the visitors. Not that the Clippers ever had many parents who made road trips. Michael even noticed what looked like a small green press box set up on the Westchester South side of the field, even though he couldn't imagine what kind of press would want to be covering their game. Maybe the public address announcer sat up there. They had heard somebody testing a microphone, a voice coming from unseen speakers, when they had filed out of the bus. When he heard the voice coming from the speakers, Manny immediately turned himself into the Yankees' PA announcer, the one who sounded like the voice of God.
Now coming in to pitch for the Clippers, Manny said,
making his voice even deeper than Anthony's.
Michael Arroyo, number 33.
Pause.
Arroyo,
Michael said. I'm not sure that's exactly how he does it, the Yankee guy.
Close enough,
Manny said. Michael said, I still think it needs work.
I sound exactly like him and you know it, Manny said. Jealousy does not become you, star. I'm just telling you that as a friend.
I try to keep it under control, Michael said. Justin the Jerk started for Westchester South. As far as Michael and the guys could tell, he spent more time before the game staring Michael down than warming up. After they had finished taking infield and outfield practice and were back at their bench, Anthony Fierro came up to Michael. Anthony could be just as funny as Manny. He just didn't try as hard. Or as often.
Blondie boy seems to think this is the finals of the Olympic stare-down event, Anthony said.
Anthony was about the same shape as Justin, a little shorter than Michael, but heavier and solid. One time in a game, there had been a grounder to Anthony at first, and Michael thought he had to get off the mound and cover first base, only at the last second, Anthony decided to sprint for the base himself. They arrived at the same moment. Michael couldn't get out of the way. The two of them collided. Michael ended up about halfway to the home team's bench at McCombs. The star, Manny had said to him later,
seeing stars. Anthony, Michael knew, wasn't afraid of anybody or anything.
That guy's a punk. You can just see it, he said.
All I did was strike him out,
Michael said. Kel said, seems like the boy still got some issues going for him on that there. Justin was staring at them from the mound now, while his team took infield practice. Kel stepped forward, gave the kid what he called his buggy look, eyes all wide, giving a little shake to his head as he did.
Kel, Michael said, you've got to lead off tonight, and he's got the ball.
Manny said,
yeah, but you've got it later.
They went and sat down next to Manny on the bench, giving him room, because he was doing what he did before every game, neatly laying out his equipment, mask, chest protector, shin guards. Manny called them his instruments. Anthony nodded at his instruments now.
You know what they really call a catcher's stuff?
Manny was fiddling with the straps on his shin guards.
What?
The tools of ignorance,
Anthony said, then put his hand up, as if inviting high fives from the group.
I'm not even dignifying your ignorance with a comment, Manny said. You're a tool of ignorance.
That got a laugh out of everybody. From the mound, they heard old Justin say, what's so freaking funny? Manny, who couldn't keep a thought inside his head sometimes, said,
you are Skippy.
The guy bit.
My name's not Skippy.
Kel stood up, stared out at him.
But you look exactly like a Skippy. No lie.
Why don't you come out here and say that?
Justin said, gesturing with what looked like a pretty expensive glove. Anthony stood up now, stepped in front of Kel.
Hey, dude, why don't you take a chill pill?
Then Mr. Minaya appeared, as if out of nowhere, and shooed them all back on the bench, reminding them about the team rule. No trash talk. Ever. Under any circumstances. No matter how much trash the other side was talking at them.
Now quiet down, he said.
As usual, Manny thought, quiet down applied to everybody on the team except him.
Well, as my mom likes to say, he said, this should certainly be a festive occasion.
Little did they know. Chapter 10. It was the top of the fourth inning. Manny pointed to Justin.
He may be as pretty as Brad Pitt, Manny said, but the boy can pitch.
Like mad pitch, Kel said, Justin having struck him out twice now. Michael was used to the way Kel talked by now, and how his cool way of talking seemed to influence the other guys on the team, and Maria too. So mad with him was a way of amping up whatever word came next. Maria was mad good-looking. Michael had, like, a mad arm. Dave Chappelle, who Michael only got to see in the movies, never on television, was mad funny. Like that.
Before, Anthony Fierro said now,